local officials bend to public pressure and put the brakes on the Lot J project. Good morning and Happy New Year. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a great holiday and your new year is off to a good start. We are beginning the new year with a conversation with the civic group Our Jacks as they call for a timeout on Lot J. Give us a call now with your thoughts. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Then later, a conversation with the author of The Case for Keto as the nation goes on that New Year's diet. That's later on. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic in Florida. Of course, vaccinations are slowly rolling out in our area and around the state with some hiccups there. At the same time, the U.S. death toll from coronavirus has climbed past 350,000. That is the most of any country, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. In our area, or rather in Florida, the state's health department says 1,365,436 positive tests for COVID were recorded over the weekend, an increase of 10,000 in just one day, and 97 more resident deaths from Saturday's count. So nearly 22,000 people in the state have died from the virus. We'll continue to cover the pandemic and the rollout of vaccinations around the state this month, but we are kicking off 2021 this morning with a closer look at the latest on Lot J. That is the proposed development next to TIAA Bank Field envisioned by Jaguars owner Shad Khan that would cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars if it's approved. This month, the Coalition of Voices is renewing their call for closer scrutiny of the deal or even to put it on pause. This morning, we welcome Michael Ward, president of the civic advocacy group OurJacks.com. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. Happy New Year. Also on the line, Audrey Moran, spokesperson for OurJacks. Audrey, Happy New Year to you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
What are your questions, everyone, about Lot J as we engage with OurJacks.com about the Lot J deal? Call us now, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJacks. And our Facebook page is open too. Mike Ward, president of OurJacks.com, former CEO of CSX. Let's begin with you. You ran an editorial about Lot J in Sunday's Florida Times Union, asking Jaguars president Mark Lamping to take the Lot J proposal off the table. Why are you making this stand?
Well, this process has really been highly flawed. OurJacks is about transparency, accountability, and we failed in this Lot J deal, just as we did with the JEA deal, to fully vet this and have the kind of proper evaluation we do for any major development within our city.
And when you say failure, what do you mean by that? The argument for this is that it would be a solid investment in beefing up downtown business, downtown foot traffic, developing the sports complex. Why is this a failure?
Well, Melissa, we are not against the Lot J deal. We think it would be great to have a development like that. What we're concerned about is the current deal in front of us. Normally this would be one of the largest investments we've ever made as a city, and it did not go through the normal process of the Downtown Investment Authority negotiation, taxpayer protection, making sure there are clear plans. The details of this were not done like any other project, and this is the largest investment our city will make in decades, and we just think we need to take a pause. Let's do this the proper way, put it through a negotiation with the Downtown Investment Authority, and come up with a deal that pays more than 44 cents on the dollar.
Audrey Moran, this is up to the Jacksonville City Council. They are facing headwinds from the public who've spoken out. I think we just lost Audrey's call as we try to get her back. Mike Ward, the City Council is facing some serious headwinds on this. They're getting pressure from the public and groups like yours and other groups who've spoken out against the taxpayer piece of this deal. At the same time, they're getting a lot of pressure from the Jaguars front office and the mayor's office to approve this deal. So how is this going to shake out? Where do you think the votes are on this thing?
Well, first of all, we're very pleased that a number of citizens are speaking up with their concerns on this. our council members need to take their fiduciary responsibility seriously and take a look at, is this a good deal for our city as it's currently structured? And I think clearly the answer to that is no. The Downtown Investment Authority was allowed to do a cursory review of it, and they said this bread box loan, or gift you may call it, clearly is not needed for the Cordish companies to have an adequate return on the investment. And I think the council members need to listen to their constituents and step back, reevaluate this proposal.
Okay, we have Audrey Moran now. In the editorial your group ran Sunday, Audrey, you said, Lot J is poisoning the well of public opinion. The same people you want to invest $400 million in your project are also your fans, your audience, your customers, your market. So this is a direct message to the Jaguars, who, by the way, just fired their head coach and are looking to possibly bring in Urban Meyer and win some more games. Do you think if the Jaguars had more of a winning record and we weren't in the middle of a recession and a pandemic, this might not be so controversial?
I don't think this has anything to do with Jacksonville's love for the Jacksonville Jaguars. We love our team, win or lose. We'd rather win, and hopefully that's not too far in the future. But it's really not about the Jaguars. It is about city priorities and getting the best deal for city taxpayers. And I think what the pandemic has shown us is that private financing has dried up for office space, for hospitality, for entertainment districts. Private financing banks are simply not loaning money for those things. It is just too uncertain a time. That's why the city has to come in as a financing mechanism. And that is also why we have put our city council members in a completely untenable position. They are not expert developers, other than Randy DeFour, who does negotiate those kind of deals. But the rest of them don't have any expertise in this. And that is why having the Downtown Development Authority take back the deal, walk through it from the beginning, and have some real experts look at the terms, that is something we can support. That is something the taxpayers deserve, and we didn't get it, and we need to stop and do it right.
And how likely is that to happen? What is the DIA and the CEO there, Lori Boyer, former city council president, saying to you about your group about this?
Well, I think they can only do what they can do. The deal was originally written so that it bypassed the DIA. The DIA didn't even get to touch it until the city council asked them to take a cursory look at what it was. But they have tremendous skill sets to really do this deal right. And that's why we're saying stop, put the deal back to the beginning, and let's go ahead and do the negotiations right. This is a lot of money, $250 million plus over $100 million in interest. These are extraordinary times, and we as a city want to dream big, but we want to dream smart. We haven't dreamt smart here. We need to back up, start over, and do this right.
Mike Ward, before we go to callers, one more question for you. What about the argument that a deal like this always requires some kind of public investment? Are you saying that the city should not be, that this should be privately financed, or are you saying that the city's piece of this should be less?
I think clearly this kind of projects does require city investments, and we're not against city investments. What we are for, though, is smart city investments, something that returns more than 44 cents on the dollar. Normally, the goal is to at least get a dollar for dollar return. This deal is much, much less than that. So we're not against public support. We're not against Lot J. We're against this deal, which did not go through the proper process, and is not a good investment for our taxpayer dollars.
Let everybody know it's your chance on this first show of our new year to share your opinion about the Lot J deal. We're speaking with the leadership of the civic group, Our Jacks. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Give us a call. It's our first show of 2021 this morning. Johnny is in Washington Heights. Hi, Johnny. Happy New Year. Go ahead.
Happy New Year, Melissa. Well, I guess I'm going to be calling as Johnny from Springfield now, since I called from my business in Springfield.
Okay, what's your business? Give a plug for your business.
No, we won't plug today, but
But
my statement and comment is, like, everybody's talking about return on investment, and they're concerned about spending this money when And they just spent, like $300 million on the courthouse down there that brings back zero money, and it stands as a symbol of oppression for most of the city. And it's a sad thing when you ride around Jacksonville Friday night at 11 a.m. or 12 a.m. and there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to eat. There's no bars. And this is before the pandemic. You know, and that's just my concern, because it's a lot of us who don't want to sit in the house, and it looks like we go out of our way to preserve our rural character for some reason, and that's my statement.
All right, Johnny, thanks for that. Mike Ward, we're getting comments on our Facebook page as well. Here's one from Susan. What do you make of City Council member Gaffney's comments? Didn't he say that God told him this was a good deal? And he said he got other assurances for help. Did he mean for his nonprofit or his district? What were those promises? What about this aspect of the deal? The pressure that's being placed on local officials, and even what they might be being promised if they vote in favor of the deal?
Well, Melissa, clearly we're not privy to any promises that have been made or that sort of thing. What we do know is our council members have a duty to the citizenry to make sure we are investing money wisely. And this deal does not do that. So I think they need to step back, and as Audrey said, let's put this in hands of the expert, the Downtown Investment Authority. The city council has the power to do that. They know that the citizenry is up in arms about this, and they need to listen to the taxpayers who they represent and put this deal back to step one and do it the proper way with full transparency, accountability, and responsibility for the parties that do these kind of things on a daily basis and are experts at it.
Do you believe the mayor should recuse from any further position on this deal?
Well, I really don't want to dictate or even suggest to the mayor what he do, but I think clearly he needs to listen to the outcry of the citizenry as well as he considers his next step.
Audrey Moran, certainly Mayor Curry has come down heavily in favor of this deal and is encouraging the city council to vote in favor of it. What is your position on those who've said he should recuse, given the perception that this deal wasn't done in a transparent manner?
Well, I think asking the mayor to recuse himself from the biggest investment in our city's history is probably not doable. He's already in the middle of this. It was his office that negotiated the deal and his office that has advocated strongly for the deal from day one. And so recusing him is really, I don't believe, even necessary, because the deal has been negotiated on the terms that Mayor Curry approved. And now it is up to the city council to make sure that the taxpayers are getting what they deserve with their taxpayer dollars. And that means stopping and starting over. If we start over with the Downtown Investment Authority, the mayor will be out of the pocket, because that is an independent authority with experts looking at the best return on investment for taxpayers. So if the city council does its job, listens to its citizens, and says, we need to stop and start over, and for all intents and purposes, the mayor will remain an advocate, but he'll be out of the details of the deal.
Part of the argument your group, OurJags.com, is making is that there is no pressing deadline for Lot J, that the Jaguars are bound to a lease that extends through the year 2030. Audrey, what about the pressure city officials might be facing that if they don't sign off on this deal, that the city could lose the Jaguars franchise?
Well, that's already been stated. And, you know, I think there's always the risk for any NFL city to lose their team. But you need, if you're going to lose the team over a deal that is unfair, untransparent, clouded in secrecy, then so be it. But we don't want to lose the Jaguars. We love that team. We want them to stay in Jacksonville. And I believe Shad Khan and Mark Lamping and all of the other people on the Jaguars side of the deal, the Cordish side of the deal, understand the need for the city to protect the taxpayer. It's a give and take. It's a negotiation. It can't be a giveaway. I'm sure they understand that. They, of course, want the best deal they can get. But the idea that they expect us to just hand over money, hand over fist, I think they are smarter than that. They know there's going to be pushback with that, and I'm sure they're ready to negotiate. If they believe in this deal as much as they say they do, if they believe it's that important to the Jaguars and to our city, then let's roll up our sleeves and really talk turkey about what's fair for the Jaguars and what's fair for the citizens. You know, there's also a lot of people saying the next thing to come will be stadium renovations. Those have topped over $1 billion in other cities. Should we be talking about the stadium renovations with Lot J? Many people think that's the case, that it would be smarter to have the conversation in a package. But at the end of the day, what RJAX is saying is, do it in the sunshine. Do it transparently, with integrity, and make sure we build in accountability into this deal.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the leadership of the civic group RJAX about the Lot J deal. What do you think? Give us a call. It's our first show of the new year. Lots of calls. David in Jacksonville. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, ma'am. I was just calling in because we are against the Lot J proposal. As a former small business owner in Jacksonville, after watching the assistance that was rolled out for the pandemic for all the small businesses and all the people in Jacksonville, I'm just curious as to why we as taxpayers have to give Shad Khan so much money when so little was done for the small businesses here. When people can't get unemployment assistance, how come we are having to pay a billionaire to live in our own city and to develop our own city, but we can't get anything for our neighbors? We can't get anything for ourselves, but we should pay for Shad Khan's development? I just don't see that as being a fair deal for the citizens of Jacksonville.
All right. Thanks, David. Mike Ward, yes. Comments saying much the same on our Facebook page. Here's one from Adrian. Shad Khan needs to make an investment of his own. Do what other NFL owners have done and build a new stadium with his new money, or make a long-term commitment to keep the Jaguars here until 2050 or beyond. Okay, so what about this? The public sentiment that was expressed by the caller and some people who are commenting on our digital platforms, that in these times when there's been so little relief for business owners, for people who are unemployed, it simply is going down like a sour taste in many mouths that now the city is poised to spend this much of the public purse on this project when Mr. Khan is a man of such means. Now, as you said, that's really not relevant to how these deals are put together, but the public perception is certainly one that of seeing this as misplaced priorities, I think.
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Khan, but I think he wants what's good for Jacksonville, and I think he wants us to be a success as a city. I think he wants the Jaguars to be a success. As RJ alluded to, he and the Cordish Company tried to negotiate the best deal they could for themselves, as they should, but we don't think it was a deal that turns out to be fair to us. I think David's point, there are many needs in this city, and one of the things we need to examine, the city council needs to examine, we have limited resources. Is this the best possible use of those resources? And I think that's a very valid question, given that these are tough times with the coronavirus. Is this the best use of the monies? And even if it is this the proper deal? One thing, and I, obviously many of your listeners are concerned about this, the one thing I'd like to encourage them is let them, their city council members, know their concern. The council needs to hear from their citizens and know their views on this so they can take that into consideration when they're voting on this this week.
That's right. The vote is this week, by the way. Elizabeth in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Elizabeth. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm part of a civic group out here in Atlantic Beach, Beaches Activist Movement, and we have both Big Jack fans and a lot of questions about this deal as well. In order to educate ourselves, which is a lot of what we're about, we're holding a meeting on Zoom on Thursday night at 7 p.m., and have invited some of the people you've got on the call now, some others, several representatives of our Jack. Will Tutwiler from the Jags is going to be there. We've invited the mayor and the NAACP. And we would encourage anybody who wants to know more about this to join us for that. To get a Zoom link, you would go to our website at beachesactivist.com and click the events link. And we'd love to have you join.
And is your group taking a position or just trying to get more information on the deal?
Our group has not formally taken a position yet. We've been trying to get educated. This came a little bit out of the blue to us, and there's a bit of the deja vu from JEA feeling about it, that it came together quickly and without the proper transparency. So we are concerned about that, and we've already been writing council about that.
All right, Elizabeth. Yeah, check that out, everybody. It's Thursday night. Virtually, of course. 549-2937. Jack is in the Intercoastal area. Hi, Jack. Happy New Year to you. Go ahead.
Happy New Year to everybody. So I agree that Lot J is a very bad deal right now. I've written on how I think it is shows the misplaced priorities of our city. But after the DIA, or after the DIA took the staff report and watered it down so heavily to remove a lot of the criticisms of the Lot J deal and kind of turn them into very lukewarm suggestions, how can we trust the DIA to do a thorough vetting of this that doesn't turn into another watered-down report that still at the very end says, keep the deal pretty much the same?
Thank you, Jack. Audrey Moran. Lots of cynicism about whether all of the... We keep losing Audrey Moran's call. Sorry about that. We'll keep trying to reconnect her. Mike Ward, what about the cynicism that this is... The fix is in on this, essentially, and that there won't be a real vetting process?
Well, if you really think about it, the DIA was not invited until the very last minute to do what I would call a cursory review. I think they were given several days to look at this deal. And they did note a number of issues that they think were inappropriate, especially the bread box loan of $65 million, which they did not even feel was necessary for the Cordish company to make a sufficient return. I think it would be different if we turned it over to the DIA and say, do your normal process. Take your experts and negotiate as you would with any other entity that wanted us to invest our precious city dollars. I think we'd have a much different result than take a couple of days and sort of look at this cooked deal, but rather to renegotiate it as they do with any other major investment of our city dollars.
Paul is downtown. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
I'm great. Happy New Year. Go ahead with your thoughts.
Well, living and working downtown, Lot J is not considered downtown. And with Lot J succeeding, it's going to draw just about all of the oxygen out of what's going on downtown. Now, what we've been trying to build up, people will want to go down to the new stuff down at Lot J, and we'll have even a worse downtown than we have now. It's interesting the DIA, Downtown Investment Authority, weren't involved in the very beginning and are getting into it now, but that's their title, Downtown Investment Authority. That's not a downtown core issue. Neither is where I live out by the new lofts that have been built in La Villa aren't considered downtown until the city wishes to count who lives downtown. And then they consider them in the core of downtown. But if you look for economic dollars for the core of downtown, they don't consider our area in the core of downtown either.
All right, Paul, thanks for that. Okay, Audrey Moran, opinion of Paul, who lives and works in downtown, that the Lot J site isn't technically in the urban core. And then I want to ask you about this, too. We have an email from Nancy Powell, Executive Director of Scenic Jacksonville. She says, I'm concerned about the resiliency aspects. We're hearing that the project would be built 8 to 12 feet higher than the floodplain. But the stormwater pond is supposed to be filled in for a surface lot. Where will the stormwater go? So those are two more wrinkles to this that I wanted to present to you and our Jacks. The notion that this isn't really supporting downtown development and concerns about how close the new construction will be to the St. Johns River.
Well, Paul's comments are well-founded. It is not in the core of downtown. And you'll recall when Mayor Payton was in office, he really focused on the Laura Bay Street corridors because he wanted to get some traction and some density for activities in downtown Jacksonville. And so that was his focus. While Lot J is within the DIA boundaries, it's not core downtown. That doesn't mean we shouldn't activate other places in and around downtown, but it goes back to the sense of priorities. What are our priorities? What is the master plan, and how does it fit into that? Those questions haven't been answered yet. As for the resiliency aspect, we have a brand new resiliency officer in Jacksonville. I'm very proud of, or getting ready to hire one, very proud of that fact. We're behind other cities by 5 and 10 years on this, but it's an issue we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about the environmental aspects of Lot J, which we already know are incredibly significant, and also how is that going to withstand hurricanes, floodwaters, stormwaters. Again, lots of questions, lots of vetting that needs to be done. Let's start over and get this right.
Mike Ward, your final comments on this as you try to make the case to the public and to the city council.
I guess my final comment would be to plead with your readers, please contact their council members and let them know their concerns. This is not a good deal for our city. We're not against Lot J development. We're against this deal, and as Audrey stated, we need to stop, restart, and come up with a deal that makes sense for the city and in total.
Thank you, Mike Ward, president of Our Jax, and spokesperson Audrey Moran. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead on the show. Later in the hour, we've got details on a free entrepreneur intensive this month for female business owners. That's coming up later in the hour. But up next.
So the case for keto begins with the case against the conventional wisdom.
If you're like most Americans, you're looking to shed some pounds in this new year. After the break, we'll speak with the author of The Case for Keto. That's next. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Don't go away.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. Asylum seekers used to be able to wait in the U.S. to have their case heard. Under President Trump, they've had to wait their turn in Mexico, sometimes in danger. Joe Biden promised that on day one he would change that, but what if he can't? An update on the Remain in Mexico program, that's next time on The World.
Tomorrow at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new year, and if you're like me and many other people, you probably ate a little too much over the festive period, didn't work out very much, and you want to get back into a more fit rhythm. Well, here's an idea. Based on a decade of research and interviews with hundreds of physicians, The Case for Keto is a new book explaining how the conventional thinking on obesity has been wrong, and eating a new way is actually what author Gary Taubes says is the right way to lose weight. Here's that conversation. Hey, Gary, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk about the science and the case you make in your book, The Case for Keto. This is the time when everyone is looking to get in shape, as they typically do in January. And they are looking to eat in a more healthy manner after all the sugar and carbs we indulged in over the holidays. We know those aren't good for us, but I want to ask you about why the keto diet, in your view, is the way to go. How do you convince people who have heard of the keto way of eating, but they may feel that it's too extreme for them, maybe, or that it's too difficult to shift to this way of eating? Tell us about the case for keto.
Okay, so the case for keto begins with the case against the conventional wisdom. So for 50 years or 100 years, we've been hearing that the way to lose weight is to eat less and exercise more. And at the very least, we could eat in moderation, and that'll help the problem. And as I've argued in all my books, I'm kind of distilling down in this one with the help of 120-odd physicians that I interviewed. Our fat accumulation, we accumulate fat largely in response to the secretion of the hormone insulin. So we think of insulin as controlling blood sugar and insulin being a problem within diabetes. But insulin tells fat cells to store fat and hold on to fat. And so when your insulin levels are elevated, you are storing fat. It's just a fact of human physiology. And for 200 years, there has been the argument that if you want to lose weight, you have to restrict the carbohydrates that you've already said are bad for us. So we agree there now. Starches, grains, sugars, particularly sugars, beer, are fattening. That's the thinking, and the idea is they're fattening because of their effect on insulin secretion. So I'm arguing in this book that any diet works when you restrict the carbohydrate content, because the carbohydrates are literally fattening. And then the keto is the extreme. That's where you abstain, in effect, from carbs entirely. And you, by doing so, you replace the carbohydrates with fatty foods. And we can discuss that, because that's a sticking point.
Yeah, but let me ask you about that. People still have a reluctance to do that. They still feel that that will make them fat, even though the science says it won't, right?
Well, and that's the problem. I got into this. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nutritionist. I have a science background, a hard science background. I was an investigative science journalist, fascinated by controversial science, good science and bad science. And beginning in the late 90s, I did a series of investigations for the journal Science about the evidence base of what had become sort of the standard thinking on a healthy diet. So that's, you know, low salt, low fat, mostly plants. Turns out that the science behind that was terrible. And that's what got me into this whole field. I spent a year on a single article, single magazine article on the dietary fat story. And it turns out there was never really the evidence to tell us we should eat low-fat diets. But now, you know, 20 years later, for people to do what's necessary for them to, you know, achieve and maintain a healthy weight, almost the first thing you have to do is shed this idea that you know, the fat in the diet is going to make you fat, and the fat in the diet is going to give you heart disease. It's just not true. I don't know how else to put it.
As long as you don't combine it with a lot of refined carbohydrates, too, right?
It's conceivable, and again, I'm going to use the word conceivable because it's not proven one way or the other. It's conceivable that dietary fat and even saturated fat is particularly atherogenic is a technical term. It's particularly likely to cause heart disease if you're eating a high-sugar diet with it. But if you're not eating a high-sugar diet, then the fat's benign. And now, you know, one of the other things that happened here is the fat that we store is actually the fat that we eat. So this was realized in the 1960s, and researchers said, well, since we're storing the fat we eat, if we tell people to eat less fat, then they won't get as fat, right? But what they didn't realize is that what regulates the storage of fat is the carbohydrates we eat. Mm-hmm. So even though we store the fat we eat, the way you get fat out of your fat tissue is weirdly enough not eating carbohydrates.
And is that what you do now? Is that the way you eat?
Yeah, I tried this as an experiment 20 years ago. It was recommended by a scientist at MIT who said if I was writing about fat, I had to try Atkins. So keto today used to be Atkins. So I did it as an experiment. I lost 25 pounds in 6 weeks. It's bizarre.
Wow. So what was a typical day of eating for you?
Well, back then, and I described this in my first major article on it, which was for the New York Times Magazine. I'd start the morning with eggs and bacon and sausage. I lived in New York then, so I would go to a diner across the street, and I would eat the eggs and bacon and think about when I'm going to have my heart attack because I had been programmed like everyone else. Lunch, you know, I was a writer, so I would eat out every meal. I'd go to a local cafe, and I'd order a roast chicken, and I'd ask them to hold the potatoes and give me a double order of vegetables or a double order of salad, and dinner would be much the same. So it's interesting, when you do this right, you're basically just not eating starches, sugars, and grains, and you replace those calories with, you know, fatty foods and green leafy vegetables. So mm-hmm. I was eating more vegetables than I ever had in my life, despite my mother always telling me to eat my vegetables.
you finally did it.
And
so,
yeah, the point I'm making in this book also is, I mentioned I interviewed 120-odd physicians. I estimate there's a few tens of thousands worldwide now who've converted to this way of thinking. And one reason they do is because they struggled with their weight like everyone else, or were struggling with their blood sugar, and they were following the conventional wisdom and eating what they knew to be a healthy diet. And many of them were, you know, world-class athletes, a few of them, and it didn't stop them from getting fatter. So they, you know, looked around, tried different things, tried vegan diets, and vegetarian diets, and Mediterranean diets, and finally they got to this very low-carb, high-fat keto diet, and it fixed them.
What about, let me ask you, what about critics of the keto diet? Those who have said that it might have long-term implications for health. What's your response there?
And it might. And one of the problems, and this was, you know, one of the things that was clear to me when I started is working on this as a journalist 20-some years ago, we don't have long-term studies for any of these diets. So when the government put us on a low-fat diet in the 1980s, we didn't have the studies then to say that that was a healthy way to eat. That was actually the dietary fad. Until then, the conventional wisdom was that carbohydrates were fatness. And we transformed the carbohydrate into the heart-healthy diet food that it's been ever since. And we don't have long-term clinical trials. We don't have the clinical trials to say the Mediterranean diet is healthy. We don't have them for the DASH diet that's promoted. And we don't have them for the, you know, low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet. What we have, it may be the most studied dietary program. I just went to this website called clinicaltrials.gov, and there's about 180 clinical trials of this diet for virtually every disease you can imagine or disorder, because it so frequently turns out to be beneficial.
Well, let me ask you then, Gary, as we kick off the new year and people are looking to get in shape and lose weight, what's your advice to someone who is thinking about trying the keto diet? What's the easiest way to sort of ease into this?
Okay. First of all, read my book, obviously. That's why I wrote it.
Sure.
People find, and again, talking to physicians, people find different ways to ease into. Some think, you know, are you the kind of person that when you're confronted with a cold swimming pool, you jump in the deep end, or you, you know, walk in slowly from the shallow end? And we're all different in that sense. What I'm trying to get people to understand is that there's copious studies demonstrating how safe this was. So remember, when I tried it 20 years ago, I was assuming I was going to have a heart attack any day. Now we know that's just not true. People get healthier when they eat this way. And if you understand that, what you want to get to is a diet that sort of minimizes sugars, starches, and grains.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's abstaining from carbohydrates, and then you can eat as much as you want of all the, you know, the green vegetables and the what we would call the protein portion of the meal, but it's protein and fat. You know, some people just go cold turkey. The world is full of books now and websites that'll help and keto-friendly foods that you could order on Amazon. Again, 20 years ago, this was relatively hard to do. Now it's effortless.
Now it's everywhere.
There's some and there's some wonderful websites that
and there's your book. So
this is the
book to read this month. It's The Case for Keto, and he's author Gary Taubes. Thanks so much for being here, Gary. Happy New Year, and it's fascinating stuff. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
In a moment, it's a new free course this month for female entrepreneurs making changes in the new year. We'll be right back. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
Greeks in Tarpon Springs host a unique Epiphany celebration every January 6th. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will visit Tarpon Springs. We'll talk with Dr. Connie Lester, editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly, and visit the Air Force Space and Missile Museum. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
The demand for traveling nurses has increased in the pandemic, which, for hospitals that need them, can be tricky.
they leave quickly or they find another assignment. And I think it's just because there's so much demand. They can go anywhere. Everybody needs them.
I'm Rima Khreis. Traveling nurses in this pandemic, that's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. Asylum seekers used to be able to wait in the U.S. to have their case heard. Under President Trump, they've had to wait their turn in Mexico, sometimes in danger. Joe Biden promised that on day one he would change that. But what if he can't? An update on the Remain in Mexico program. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The last time the Senate was majority Democrat, it was 2015, and Joe Biden was Senate president. Now Biden's going to be the actual president, and the fate of the Senate rests with one very purple state. We go down south and check in on Georgia ahead of the runoffs. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, did you know that women have been leaving the workforce in massive numbers in this pandemic we've all been struggling through? Yeah, more than 2 million women left the workforce between February and October last year because women are called on to both earn money and be the caregiver for those in their circle who need help. In the pandemic, that pressure forced many capable, hardworking women out of traditional work. Many of them are now looking to start their own business that might allow them some more flexibility, but also make sure they can earn a living. This month, you can take part in a free 2-week Entrepreneurs Intensive to kickstart your female-owned business. She Is Fierce CEO Kelly Youngs has put this together, and she is on the line now. Kelly, Happy New Year. Good morning.
Happy New Year, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you and your positive attitude in this challenging time. And as you are well aware, millions of women had to leave the workforce in the pandemic. So you've put together a free program they can access online to power up, you call it Power Up Your Profile and Profits. Tell us about it.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, as you know, She Is Fierce has been around for a few years now, and we always work with professionals and entrepreneurs. We've been doing this for a long time. But in 2021, I decided to really turn our focus, especially in this month of January, when everybody is getting ready and planning for the year ahead, to female entrepreneurs. Because as you said, women are leaving the workforce, but they still have to actually earn money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to help support their families. So many are looking to entrepreneurship. And then those who are business owners, who have been business owners, have had many, many challenges over the last, 10 months. And so, to be honest, in 2020, the vast majority of questions that I got from our members, from women in our community all over the world, were business questions. And so we put together this free Entrepreneurs Intensive. And as you said, it's all about powering up your profile and profit. So it's helping women to create a brand for their business and actually create a profitable business. Because there are many, many business owners out there that are running a business, doing a great job. They're incredibly capable. And yet they just can't seem to bring money home and support their families. And I think that profitability is a factor that we don't talk about enough. So we're going to focus in on that. So whether you're just getting started in your business or whether you are, 5 or 10 years down the line and you're just looking to get to the next level, this is the perfect quick 2-week program to get women started.
And by the way, this is free. So you don't have to pay a dime to access all these learnings, this wisdom. As you know, women-owned businesses struggle to hit higher revenue targets, even though there are 13 million women-owned businesses in the United States. SCORE, the nation's largest network of volunteer and expert business mentors, finds that that is because of sexism. Frankly, women's expertise is dismissed more easily. They have to work harder and longer to gain credibility and grow their business. They're less likely to get venture capital funding. They don't have as much access to networks that are traditionally male-dominated. when it comes to getting capital and other resources. So they tend to be isolated. So what you're trying to do is grow a network of women business leaders and professionals to respond to that.
Exactly. Yeah. And we actually, you know, of course, we're based here in North Florida. It is my favorite place to be. But we also have women who are members all over the world. We have members in 9 countries. And they are, as you said, they're professional leaders. And they're also entrepreneurs who are maybe just getting started, but also entrepreneurs who are running multiple six-figure or million-dollar businesses and are looking for help, support, resources to get them to that next level, and a sense of community and connection with other people. And you really touched on it. I think it's easy for us to dismiss and say, oh my gosh, there's so many networking opportunities out there for women or men or anybody. But the truth is that the vast majority of women don't have access to high-level, successful entrepreneurship programs because often they start with a barrier. So, oh, you have to be at 6 figures or you have to be at $1 million. And so women who are just getting started and just learning the ropes or trying to hit that first 6 figures don't have access to the insight and the knowledge of a community of people that can help them.
So if this sounds like something you would benefit from, sign up now for the free Power Up sessions this month. It's sheisfiercehq.com/powerup. Full disclosure, I lead Jacksonville events for She is Fierce, although we haven't been doing any in-person ones, Kelly. but we will at some point, hopefully soon.
I'm so excited. We are going to be doing in-person events again in 2021. We are, as you know, Melissa, we are trying to do it as responsibly as possible. But we are working hard with our team to plan some really phenomenal events. And we've used this time, just like we have in trying to focus on entrepreneurs, to come up with programming that is going to take it to the next level. So when we do finally come together again, our events are going to be even better and more amazing.
And in the meantime, check out the free 2-week Entrepreneurs Intensive to help female entrepreneurs power up your profile and profits. This is free. Sign up at sheisfiercehq.com/powerup. As we power up the new year, CEO Kelly Young's on the line. Hey, Kelly, thanks so much, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And you can catch our podcast up later today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect at WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Let's make this a good year.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.